Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation on this Aloha Friday, May 16th. Today we talk tariffs, this time with a company that imports fireworks. Yep, from China. A tariff hike of 145% could make the cost of the popular import prohibitive. And imagine this, waiting a year to get your teeth examined. We talk about dental health on Molokai, why relief is on the way. We hear from a former Olympian about getting back into athletics after a scandal derailed her career. She's competing in this weekend's triathlon in Honolulu, why she feels it's time for a comeback story. And as we mark Asian American Pacific Islander Month, we celebrate Aloha Everything, an illustrated book for young readers that's been racking up awards. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. President Donald Trump's tariff threats stand to impact one industry that grabbed the headlines earlier this year. We're talking about the business of fireworks. In January, we saw an illegal aerial event that injured scores of people and took the lives of six, including a three-year-old child. Here on Oahu, Hilton Resorts puts on a fireworks show in Waikiki, which I can see every Friday from where I live. I wondered how the tariff talk stands to impact the company behind the show. Bruce Albrecht is operations manager for Hawaii Pyrotechnics. He told me the industry had asked for an exemption from the Trump administration earlier, but so far, no luck.
During Trump's first term, our industry got an exemption. And so our industry trade group immediately went into action to try to get an exemption for this time around as well. But yeah, to have it announced that it was triple digits and across the board was definitely shocking. I don't think anybody expected that.
I mean, as I was mulling this over the other night, I thought, wow, this is an effective ban on fireworks because I would imagine it'd be cost prohibitive for you folks to bring these fireworks in.
Yes. I mean, obviously, there's just no way that we can absorb that significant of a price increase. And so, yeah, as many people are describing it, 145% tariff is essentially a trade embargo. Of course, I heard stories of, you know, all kinds of business owners stopping containers in their tracks. Just simply, as a small business, you can't afford to pay 2.5 times the amount that you were expecting, anticipating for a container. I mean, that's, you know, because those tariffs have to be paid before they'll release your product to you. So as a business owner, you got to come up with that money up front. And that's not an easy thing to do in the quantities that we're talking. For many smaller businesses, this was just a death knell. So for sure, that's what we were looking at too.
Well, I imagine you went into a panic. I mean, you folks supply the fireworks for the Hilton show, which I can see from my house every Friday. So that's what made me think of what's this going to mean.
Yeah, exactly. And the hardest thing is just the sheer unpredictability of it. For many fireworks shows that we do, the planning stages, they start 6 months, 1 year out. You know, I've got customers who are asking for pricing for events in 2026, and how am I supposed to give them a quote when I have no idea how much the product's going to cost? It's a daunting task. And, you know, at least if there was some predictability, I would be able to build in the pricing. But so far, that's been elusive. I don't know what to charge them.
And we should point out that fireworks are not made in the U.S. of A., right? They're made in China, and that's where most people get it.
Yeah, I believe the statistic is about 90-95% of all fireworks originate in China. They've been making fireworks for 600 years, and so the industry is pretty well established there. It's going to be impossible to start manufacturing them in the U.S., much less Hawaii, because of the regulatory overhead is just really high. The labor costs are very high, and so it's just not something you're going to encourage, you know, onshoring of manufacturing back to the U.S. for an industry like fireworks manufacturing. It's just about impossible.
Well, when we chatted the other day, you had mentioned that there's also planning for a big anniversary next year. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so it's the semi-quincentennial anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And of course, that'll be on July 4th, 2026. And so fireworks display companies like us, we're anticipating that many people are going to want, you know, a big celebration. And so we're already in the planning stages for that and trying to bring in some extra inventory and equipment and hiring and all that. You know, and again, it's really difficult to make those kinds of projections and investments when you're just unsure of the landscape. I mean, if your product is going to be extremely expensive or impossible to bring in, it makes it really difficult to plan those big events.
And you mentioned something about getting an exemption for the fireworks industry the last time Trump was in office, and that the association did make attempts to do that again this time?
Yeah, so definitely during his first term, there were many industries that were able to apply for and receive exemptions from the tariffs. I believe back then, if I'm not mistaken, the tariffs were 25%. And yeah, so the fireworks display industry was one of those that was able to get an exemption on that additional tariff. But this year, I mean, we've been making our attempts, but so far the administration has not been receptive to granting the kinds of exemptions for that, except for a few industries. I mean, I know that the chip industry and some electronics got an exemption, but not very many others have. So it's, yeah, we're not sure what the future holds. It's really difficult to plan.
So we might have to plan for maybe a scaled down 4th of July celebration if it just gets cost prohibitive, if you don't get the exemption.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I think we're safe for this year. We were fortunate that we have brought in our product early when we were planning ahead. I mean, not only does it take about a year to plan for a fireworks show, but, you know, we also have to put in our orders about a year in advance. And so we're safe for this year. But yeah, 2026, we'll just have to wait and see what the landscape holds in terms of global trade. And we'll go from there. Hard to predict at this point, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I was wondering out loud if, you know, Hilton would scale back their fireworks and not have it every Friday, but maybe every other Friday or once a month. But it sounds like you've got enough product for the end of the year.
Definitely. We've been doing the show for over 30 years now. And it's only, to my knowledge, it's only been suspended twice. Once was for the first Gulf War. And the second time was, of course, for COVID. But other than that, it's been every week. And we'd like to do our very best to keep it that way, because it's definitely one of the staple attractions for Waikiki, for visitors and residents alike. We'd sure like to keep it going.
Well, I was thinking, too, if these fireworks get so expensive and you aren't allowed to bring in what you normally do, that would effectively be a ban on fireworks and all the hand-wringing that we had just because of the terrible deaths and the injuries that we saw at the beginning of this year. I mean, that was very sobering, and it made everybody pause about the danger of these illegal fireworks.
Yeah, it's definitely. And we like to say, please, you know, leave it to the professionals. We feel that professional fireworks displays offer a safe alternative to enjoy fireworks, to be able to see them and really appreciate them. And of course, our technicians have all received extensive training and follow very strict safety practices to avoid, you know, risk. And so we'd hate to see the commercial display industry negatively impacted by something like tariffs, because we do feel that it offers a safe alternative for everyone.
And yes, leave it to the professionals to make the fireworks magic. We've been hearing from Bruce Albrecht, the Director of Operations at Hawaii Explosives and Pyrotechnics, Inc. He was talking about the uncertainty around the tariff talks with China and what the threat of 145% hikes mean for fireworks importers.
Today is the last day to apply for HPR's Community Advisory Board. We're looking for volunteers from across our islands to help shape the future of HPR. Neighbor Island Voices are especially welcome to apply. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org/CAB.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Aloha Air Cargo, offering 5 direct flights weekly from Honolulu to Seattle-Tacoma Airport. More information at alohaaircargo.com.
You know, remote communities are often at a disadvantage when it comes to healthcare services. On Molokai, dental health has been a particular challenge of late. Here to talk about that is HPR's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Well, I hope your dental health is okay.
It's certainly an ongoing challenge here on Molokai. There's a huge need for dental services. The Molokai Community Health Center has a 10-page waiting list to be seen, and that equates to about a year wait to see one of their providers. The Community Health Center is one of 2 dental providers on the island left right now. We just had a couple of private practice dentists retire, and there's only 1 private practice dentist left. And over the past 20 years that the Community Health Center has had a dental program, they relied heavily on visiting dentists. You know, it's really hard to attract providers, dental and healthcare on, you know, neighbor islands, particularly on Molokai. And so there's been a huge burnout of dentists, you know, coming over the past 20 years because, you know, they have to work so hard to, you know, to try and keep up with the demand. And as you said, especially recently in the past year with these retirements. So the Molokai Community Health Center is working on a huge expansion of their dental department. So there is hope in sight. They're doing a facility overhaul of their dental building. They're going from 3 dental chairs to 6 dental chairs. And they're bringing on more staff. They're bringing in hiring a full-time dentist who will be living on Molokai, which is really huge. She's worked here previously, about 7 years ago, I'm told. And so, you know, she's already familiar with the island. She kind of knows what to expect, and she's excited to be here. So that is really, really, really good news for residents, you know, on this huge wait list. Construction is underway. They're anticipating this renovation to be complete in July, with a grand opening in August. And all of this is being paid for by over $1 million in federal grant for the construction from the previous administration. And so in talking to Milton Cortez, who is the CEO of the Community Health Center, he said they're trying to finish the work, as much of the construction work as possible, by June 30th, just in case, you know, that funding gets held up after that. It sounds like they're in pretty good shape for that. But Milton Cortez explained some of the other upcoming challenges that they're going to be facing as well.
The reason why I'm moving ahead, just kind of being aggressive about that, is that we have a Medicaid issue looming with potential cuts. And a lot of the folks that are on Medicaid now, if some of the initiatives that are being discussed in D.C. go forward, one of them was a work initiative where they have to show that they're looking for work. You know, well, we have about 16, 17, just my patient population, not the population of the island, about 1,700 people on some form of Medicaid. Well, there's not 1,700 jobs in Molokai. So, that's going to be an interesting thing if that moves forward. But I have to prepare for it. So we're trying to get rid of that wait list and see as many people as possible, because come October, when the new fiscal year goes off, those people on Medicaid now will be either uninsured or underinsured. and they may not have dental services. So that's one of the areas that we're being aggressive right now.
Wow, that's pretty shocking. I mean, to require the folks on Medicaid to be looking for jobs and there are no jobs on Molokai. Wow.
Yeah, I think, you know, if that were to go through, it would have a huge impact on, you know, particularly small communities where jobs are just limited. There are 14 federally qualified health centers in Hawaii, and Milton says they're all preparing for about 10 to 15% cuts in federal funding. The proposed cuts are in public health funding, particularly to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Right now, they're projecting about 34% cut, which is $41 billion. And so that would, you know, again, have a big impact on community health centers across the country. And those cuts could happen this year. The Medicaid, Medicare cuts that are being discussed looks like it might be happening over the next several years if it goes through. And, you know, with so many of the federal things we're hearing about, the cuts, you know, it's an ever-changing timeline. And, you know, what programs are being affected is really kind of unclear from one day to the next. So a lot up in the air still, but they're certainly, you know, as he said, preparing in case these challenges come down the line. And Cortez says they're looking at different ways to make up that funding deficit, you know, looking at different options for pharmacy sourcing that would save some money, and different ways that they can cover, you know, folks who may be uninsured in the future and being able to still, you know, still required to serve, you know, residents regardless of their ability to pay. So as I mentioned earlier, on Molokai, 2 out of 3 private practice dentists have retired in the past year. And so dentist Boki Chung is the one remaining private practice dentist. She's actually been volunteering as part of this collective effort to help expand the Molokai Health Center's dental services. And she talks about the challenges of Medicaid reimbursement for dental practices. A lot of challenges there.
There is definitely a need for more dental providers. And I think the health center is very critical. A lot of our population is underinsured or not insured, or they're on Medicaid. And with Medicaid insurance, the federally qualified health centers, their reimbursement rate is very different from how private practice offices get reimbursed. And in fact, basically, if I were to work at a health center and did similar dentistry as I do in my own office, a provider would generate more money at a health center doing a similar things than they would at a private practice, because the government just doesn't pay private practices. They pay them differently and they end up paying them less if a Medicaid patient is seen at a private practice versus at a health center. So I think it's super important to have our health centers, because it's very, very difficult for private practices to sustain a big pool of Medicaid insurance patients, because you barely break even. A private practice owner barely breaks even taking Medicaid insurance if that's all they did. So that's why it's super important for the health center to succeed.
Yeah, and I bet the residents can't wait till that opens.
Yes, a lot of anticipation working through that wait list. And, you know, one of the challenges, as we talked about earlier, is just it's really hard to find dentists to work here long term. You know, there's a retiring, aging dentist population, overall shortages, you know, in dentistry and in healthcare across the board. You know, a lot of community health centers aren't able to pay, you know, a super high salary. And so, you know, the money may not be there to sort of incentivize coming to a community like Molokai. Hard to find a good fit, you know. It's rural lifestyle isn't for everyone. And so there's a lot of programs, you know, Boki Chung is among those working to kind of mentor and encourage homegrown, you know, up-and-coming students to go into the dental field and become hygienists. There are some working at the health center now. And so, you know, a lot on the horizon, some good news and continuing challenges. You know, the community health center says, you know, there's a long road to sort of building that trust and consistency as they, you know, work through that wait list and those challenges, but moving in the right direction.
Yeah, no, but, you know, that is a nice bright spot for the community to look forward to, and we'll keep our fingers crossed that the cuts that they're talking about don't actually, you know, happen as deep as they're forecasting. But thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from HPR's Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel about the lack of dental care on Molokai. Look for her stories on hawaiipublicradio.org.
Next month, Hawaii Public Radio's Live from the Atherton series presents a local jazz lineup you won't want to miss. Each Saturday in June, enjoy live performances from the Honolulu Jazz Quartet, Noel Okimoto, DeShannon Higa's Quad Pod, and the Sean Conley Quartet. Learn more at hprtickets.org, sponsored by HMSA. Support for HPR comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are providing affordable housing solutions to convert renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NereidHawaii.com.
Marion Jones was once known as the fastest woman in the world. An elite track and field athlete, she won 3 gold medals and 2 bronze medals at the 2000 Summer Olympics. But she was stripped of her medals after she admitted to lying to federal investigators about using performance-enhancing substances. She held an emotional press conference in 2007, the same day she pled guilty to 2 counts of lying under oath.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Marion Jones Thompson. And I'm here today because I have something very important to tell you, my fans, my friends, and my family. Over the many years of my life, as an athlete in the sport of track and field, you have been fiercely loyal and supportive towards me. Even more loyal and supportive than words can declare has been my family, and especially my dear mother, who stands by my side today. And so it is with a great amount of shame that I stand before you and tell you that I have betrayed your trust.
I hard to believe that was nearly 20 years ago. Today, Jones defines herself as a mom, a former athlete, and a triathlete. She touched down in Honolulu yesterday ahead of the triathlon this weekend, which takes place on Sunday. She spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about her return to the spotlight and the lessons in resilience that she wants to teach others.
People many times, I think, turn away from hard experiences thinking that they're not going to get anything out of it. But I've learned later on in life that sometimes the hardest things that you have to deal with in life can propel you to your greatest moments and your greatest achievements. I'm a believer in that. And I'm originally from California. I'm a product of a, you know, split household, parents divorced at a young age. Mom was forced to be an incredible single parent to my brother and I. And my outlet to deal with that, and I didn't know that was a thing, right? But in hindsight, I struggled with like understanding, why is this not like the perfect familial setting? Like, why is there not, you know, a father in the household and a mother in the household? And then why is the father not interested in being in our lives? Like all those things that I processed internally. Thankfully for me, I found an outlet early on, and that was sport. And I loved it. I had an older brother that was the catalyst for me to just fall in love with it. He's 5 years older than me. And I always joke, Maddie, that when your older brother starts to pick you to be on his neighborhood teams, something is unique about you. And it started early. I just loved anything physical, running, jumping, baseball, gymnastics, soccer. I just took to it so very well. And then I was also fortunate that my mom remarried and just a wonderful man who had an incredible passion for sport and going to games and watching stuff on television and talking it through. And in essence, not forcing me, but encouraging me to sit down and watch these athletes, how they are before competitions, how they are interviewed after competitions, like how they're humble, how they respond fully, how they show the passion in their face. And all of that, unbeknownst to me at the time, was certainly starting to give me little tools on how I was going to become as an individual and as an athlete. So yeah, coping with stuff for me, my outlet was a positive one. But again, I totally empathize with people who are forced to be in those type of situations and turn to potentially toxic outlets. And I just, was just so fortunate to find one that is healthy. But there, to a point, right? Because anything to an extreme is toxic. And there were certainly times in my life, and even now, where I turn to working out or the physical, like as a crutch almost, right? Because it's what I know, it's what makes me feel good. But again, anything to an extreme, and if you don't deal with the core of the issues, is always going to slowly start to eat away at you, which again, I've learned over time. It has been so far a wonderful ride. I didn't think necessarily that I would be revisiting this world of sport and competing and athleticism at almost 50. But here I am again. I can't get away from it.
Yeah. I want to, so you alluded to kind of the highs and lows of elite sports, that there are two sides to it. And I have to ask about the steroid scandal that in some ways, derailed your career. I don't know if that's the correct phrase. But what I'm interested in is how you picked up the pieces afterward and why you turned back to sports, because that feels like such a vulnerable thing.
I think just to put myself back out on the worldly scene in the past year and a half, 2 years, I took quite a hiatus from the spotlight for a lot of reasons, which I've shared. One, I needed to just get away from being under, in essence, the gun for a long time. I also, love my family and my kids and felt that there was a need to step away from it all and be their parents and be their mother and allow them to forge their own path, whether it's in sport or life, whatever. And so that hiatus of 10 plus years away from interviews and social media, like all of that was necessary. A few years ago, though, I made the decision that I believe that everybody needs to hear the story of resilience and comeback. And I believe also that God has given me the tools and the strength to be able to face it all and say, hey, poor choices were made, but life doesn't end. Like, how can you rebuild? Can you rebuild? And my answer to that is like a resounding yes. And fortunate that I have such a following of friends and fans and people from around the world who believe in this, that you don't have to be a former Olympic champion or someone with a massive name to understand that everybody, makes a poor choice and everybody falls down in some capacity, but you don't have to stay there. And if I can use my story as an example to everybody that, hey, like, if you don't believe in that concept, like, watch my career, watch my life. What it has done, it has allowed me to create my own narrative, right? Like, for so many years, my narrative was written for me by the media and right, like all of that. And what coming back out onto the scene has done was allowed me to take control of my story, right? And that my story doesn't end with a scandal. My story doesn't end with a setback. That my story ends how I want it to end, and it's not ended, right? Like, obviously it is evolving daily and constantly. And, you know, this idea that the life I thought about sport, that life is over, but because I have such a passion for movement and sport, and most importantly now, challenges, that I made the decision probably around the time, this time last year, that I wanted to cross off my bucket list a triathlon, right? Which is something for decades I've wanted to do. I've had so much respect for these athletes. And it's fairly simple why. I mean, I was a master of one, right? Like I could run fast from here to there. Yes, I could also jump far, but really people know me that, you know, the fastest woman in the world. And I was a master at that. But the idea to be a master of three disciplines, right, in the triathlon, or if you're a triathlete or know that world, it's really a fourth discipline because you have to add in nutrition to that, right? And the idea that you have to juggle mastering your swim, your cycling, your running, the nutrition, you know, at this age, with also a career and a family, like I can't think of a more powerful, inspirational, like, comeback story than this one. There's no way at 20 years old, if you would have said, Marion, you know, at 50, you're going to be attempting your first triathlon. You're going to have like a crazy comeback of sorts in other areas of your life. You know, you're going to see success in business and life is just going to be like, I would have said, okay, what are you smoking? All right. But like I'm here and it's amazing. By no means am I sitting here in Honolulu 2 days before my first triathlon saying that I'm a master of any of those now. But I'm at a place where I know that I can be competitive and you have to start somewhere. So I am not expecting to start this competition on Sunday morning and get my pro card and like all that. No, I'm going to survive on that swim because, you know, for many triathletes, they will also say that the swim part of the competition is the hardest, especially if you don't have a massive swim background. And I don't, you know, prior to starting this journey last year, October 2024, you know, I could swim, meaning I'll jump in the pool and I'll do a big cannon bomb or a dive and tread and make sure my kids don't drown and I don't drown. But in terms of laps, like what? Like I had to, like, how far is a lap? Right, 25 yards, what? And then you want me to come back and then back and then back and stay what? Learning the skill of swimming and skill work at this age is so hard. You know, it's like so difficult. And it's one of also the reasons that in this journey, I partnered with this company called SoulCap. They're based in the UK, but they make swim caps for people with a lot of hair and other products. But the partnership was driven by the fact that this company believes that swimming safety and access to swimming should be accessible to everybody. People of color, poor people, whoever, everybody should know how to swim. And that idea for me resonates like real. So this journey has led me to, I mean, I'm in Honolulu about to compete in a triathlon. If that is not the perfect example of wow, like that's quite the comeback. And you know, as time goes on, I'm starting to get more comfortable with the flow and all that, but it is not an easy task at all. And then you couple that with, you know, I'm juggling business. We brought the company that I partner with, we brought a group of very successful entrepreneurs on this tri journey, and there most of them are competing in their first triathlon here. There's like 12 women of all just like badasses when it comes to their business of sort. They signed on to be on this journey with me because they want to take what triathletes and these type of endurance athletes, what they possess, and they want to learn how to put that into their business. And so when we crawl across the finish line on Sunday, different ways, different times, what a momentous occasion it will be. Because this journey has not been easy. And particularly for me, I think it's going to all be very like full circle for me. Like me finishing this competition, hopefully, you know, very competitively, will be for me just a confirmation that life doesn't stop when you get knocked down. Everybody can reframe, reshape, rebuild who they are and what they want to be. And it takes time and it takes setbacks and hiccups and speed bumps along the way. But with persistence, consistence, and like endurance, anybody can do it. And so I'm guessing it'll be fairly emotional when I cross the line on Sunday. And it's, you know, there's certainly like some anxiety and nerves leading up to it, but I've prepared physically. I'm most excited about it, specifically with the triathlon, competing on just in a beautiful lagoon in the ocean, right? That one where I won't have to deal with that many waves. It's one of the reasons we actually chose the Honolulu Tri, as the swim one is one of the safest in the world. And with the reef and us actually swimming in the lagoon, it's fairly calm. And really, it's just a straight out and straight back. So the distance, I will be doing the sprint triathlon. There is an Olympic distance. I'm not there yet. So my swim is 750 meters. My bike is about 12 miles and my run is a 5K. And so, yeah, to get out of that water, I might just like do a cartwheel. I don't know. I probably won't because I'll be so focused. But the get done with the swim portion, which for me certainly is the most challenging, I'll be on such a high. And then to be on a course that's fairly flat in regards to the bike and fairly flat when it comes to the run, which makes for a faster run. So I'm bubbling with excitement.
Thank you so much, Marian Jones, for taking the time, and good luck this weekend.
Oh, thank you so much. And to all your listeners, have a wonderful, wonderful day.
That was elite track and field athlete Marian Jones, who will be competing in her first triathlon this weekend in Honolulu. That race starts at Ala Moana Beach Park this Sunday. The bike portion will stretch along Ala Moana Boulevard and Nimitz Highway, so expect street closures.
Hawaii Public Radio is here for you and with you. HPR's Live from the Atherton series brings our community together with stories and music that make Hawaii, Hawaii. Support community and unity with HPR. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
On this Aloha Friday, we thought it fitting to end with a segment highlighting the creative process behind a children's book entitled Aloha Everything. We celebrate two women, the author, Kaylin George, and the illustrator, May Waite. We talked with them earlier just after learning that the book won the Asian Pacific American Award, one of about a half a dozen honors that it garnered since the book was published last year. George starts us off.
Ever since we started this project, we've been just absolutely so humbled and so blown away by the incredible amount of support that we've received from the community, from readers, especially from educators, teachers, librarians, kumu. It's been really, really something absolutely remarkable. And the honors that we've received recently, it's an understatement to call the Apollo Award an honor. It's the achievement of a lifetime. And I couldn't be more grateful. We couldn't be more grateful to the community that really made it happen. I mean, first of all, of course, to the Apollo community itself, but also to everybody that has been a part of sharing Aloha Everything with readers and with schools and with libraries. And it's just been really an incredible journey, and I'm grateful that it continues to grow. It's a community that continues to grow, and the more and more people that we meet, the more special that we really realize how wonderful this experience is.
Well, in May, you know, I'm a big
picture person, you know, so I love illustrations in children's books. And the imagery in this book that you've captured, I mean, so rich and so deep.
Thank you. This was 100% a collaborative effort between Kaylin and I. And so what you see is the love child between both of our ideas, but we deeply appreciate that you resonate with the images. I don't think that these images would have been what they are today without Kaylin's beautiful writing.
Oh, thank you, Mary.
Yes, I got to give you a little shout out.
You know, we were having a little chat, May, earlier, and I was just curious, like, you know, how long would it take you to come up with one of these images? They're just very intricate.
So it really depends on the complexity of each piece. When Kaylin and I first pioneered the illustration process, we kind of took it as if we were going to paint each page as a individual art piece.
It was kind of looking at it in two ways, right, May? Because we were looking at it on one hand of, okay, we have to think about this piece in terms of how it fits within the overall series, but also looking at it in terms of if you had no other pieces next to it, if for some reason a page ripped out of the book and you only saw the one page, would it still be telling the story on its own? So it was sort of looking at it in two different angles, looking at it from two different angles.
And so how did the two of you connect? I don't know if you just had a friendship or did you see her artwork somewhere? I mean,
yeah, that's exactly what happened, actually. So I had the idea that I really wanted to create this story that was largely inspired by the stories that my mother would tell me when I was growing up. And so I had this idea, I really wanted to bring it to life. And I thought to myself, okay, if I was an illustrator, where would I be? And I just looked everywhere that I could think of. I went to art galleries and shows. I went to auctions. I called every school on the islands asking if they had talented students or alumni or professors. And ultimately, I ended up finding one of May's pieces online. And as soon as I saw it, I said, wow, that I have to find this woman. I need to meet this woman. This is absolutely remarkable. And then we ended up connecting. I actually interviewed quite a few different artists for the position. And as soon as May and I spoke, I think it was pretty clear that we had a really great opportunity for a collaboration between us, because I think we have really good communication and we just clicked really quickly. And, you know, fast forward now many, many years later, and I feel like May and I, we almost can, I think, sometimes read each other's mind. So it's really turned out to be the collaboration of a lifetime and the friendship of a lifetime. And I'm really grateful that I just happened to see her piece online. That's what started it all.
And so, Kaylin, I know that the storyline is that, you know, you remembered your mother telling you stories about growing up on Molokai. And so I'm just kind of curious, May, I mean, so the imagery that you came up with, where did you draw that?
That's a good question. So before we went into the illustration phase where we put, you know, pen to paper, we did extensive research and visual research on where we're going to compile, I guess, different scenes. And so, Kaylin, we knew that some pages were going to be allocated to either trying to explain the land and then the people and then the legends and heritage. And so we would kind of compile different images for those different categories. So I would go out to my favorite hikes and try to compile photos and videos of different scenes that I thought would fit the story and the narrative better. So that would be kind of our landscape. So the land pages, different plants along the way that I would find interesting, and doing a bunch of research on what is endemic and native and canoe species. And then we would do research on people, you know, sourcing from different
databases and
yes,
organizations. So I'll just give a quick shout out, because I just wanted to note that we had so, so much help from the community, and we're really, really incredibly grateful for it. We were in the research phase of the process for, oh gosh, I mean, years. We were researching before we even put pen to paper. We spent over a year, I think, in the research phase. And it was really made possible by a lot of incredible people who helped us to source information, to source inspirational imagery, to source books and articles, things like that. The Hula Preservation Society was really incredible throughout that process. And a lot of other incredible people people who are actually listed at the back of the book who provided us with a lot of help, ranging from Kumu to language experts to costume, you know, historical clothing experts to, you know, hula experts, all kinds of people who really were helpful throughout the process as we were conducting research and studying. And as May said, we started by just compiling reference images. And I think that was really important to me and May's process because it created a shared language between us. You know, now that May and I have been working together for many years, I think that we almost can read each other's mind. But back when we were first starting, we had to kind of create a shared language between us. And so we would look at, you know, art, we would look at photographs, we would look at articles, we would look at books, and we would kind of look at things together and reference them together and say, well, you know, what if for this page, you know, we did something that was sort of reminiscent of this piece of photography that we saw, or May would go on a hike and she would see this incredible plant and we would do research into the plant and say, what if we use this plant, you know, in the foreground of this page? And it just kind of created a vocabulary for May and I to work with. And ultimately, we sort of started with vague ideas. And what we ended up doing was we kind of compiled together a list. Once we had hundreds and hundreds of reference, I mean, honestly, maybe thousands of references, then we compiled together a list of sort of themes and subjects that we saw that were incredibly important to us that we wanted to make sure that we reflected. And so that was going to be things like, for example, a deep connection to the Aina was something that was on our list that we wanted to represent that. And then we would create folders where we would add together shared articles or photos or art pieces that reminded us of those things. And then we used all of that to kind of inspire us when we would look at a particular page. And so we'd say, okay, for page 5, I think we really want to be looking at the theme of the importance of the deep connection to Aina. What is really inspiring to us? And then we would look at the text and formulate compositions from there.
So it was really a layered process, it sounds like, right?
So many layers.
Yeah. I'm just like looking at the cover and, you know, all the native species, the honu, you know, the Kamehameha butterfly, the birds, the dragonfly. So those kinds of things, but just so layered.
Right. Because Kayla and I, like, we really have a passion for bringing the story to life. We want to make sure that we do it ethically. So making sure that we can kind of relate the images back to what we see today and also make it a learning point for children and also for adults as well. And so we meticulously thought out and planned exactly what we wanted to have in the book. We wanted to accurately portray, to the best of our abilities, the story and the culture and the history of the Hawaiian culture.
And then I know the two of you took part in a book signing recently at Barnes & Noble. But, you know, May, you and I were talking about how large these images are. And I don't know, if you have the original images, do you think you might do like a little show, you know, an exhibit?
We do actually currently have them on display. They're all in a gallery, not like an official art gallery, but they're on display in an office gallery currently. But we have definitely considered in the future to potentially have it move to new locations. And that's something we're definitely interested in. And, you know, shout out to any art galleries if they're interested.
Well, I think it would be wonderful to have a little traveling show to go to the neighbor islands.
And one thing I'll just throw out there, because I think it's really interesting. And I don't know, I think it's an interesting look into kind of me and May's process. But what's something that's really wild to me is if you look at the different illustrations, some of the illustrations, you know, once we had the research and once we had the inspiration and we started looking at compositions, May would start with what we would call a thumbnail, which would be a very, very rough sketch that would kind of just give you an idea of the composition. And we would do many of these, right? And so that's kind of what helped us to decide, okay, we want to do this, not this. And, you know, we had to make some decisions in that stage. And I think what's really interesting is that some of the illustrations we pretty much got almost immediately. If you look at the early compositions, we would try one thing and then we would try a bunch of different things, but we'd end up going back to the original idea that we had, and the first idea was the best idea, if that makes sense. And the final painting is very similar to our very first thumbnail. But then you look at other paintings and it took us dozens and dozens and dozens of tries, and actually not just thumbnails, but actually multiple sketches, multiple color swatches, multiple, you know, redoing compositions. And we'd do dozens and dozens of times before we landed on the final image. So I just think it's kind of interesting that, you know, you never know. Different pages had, you know, different sort of processes.
Well, I'm hoping that you can bring the show back to Molokai, where some of these stories, you know, originated. So I will keep my fingers crossed for you and hope that happens. Any other final thoughts, May?
I have a lot of thoughts. I don't know which one is going to be the final one. Let me think about this. Well, Kayla and I are so grateful, and it's really, really special to us for you allowing us to share our processes and what it's like, because what was actually very fascinating to me, this is my first book, and so I didn't know what an author and illustrator relationship was going to be like. And so it was really funny because Kaylin is the first kind of author experience that I've had. And I was like, this is amazing. Is this what it's going to be like all the time? Like, let me get into this. And then Kaylin, you know, further along, I'm starting to realize, wait a moment, like this is pretty irregular. And so for us to have this collaborative effort and to have this opportunity to work together is just, like Kaylin said, it's a relationship of a lifetime. And I just want to really thank Kaylin for all of her hard work and also all the people to help support this book. So thank you, Hawaii Public Radio.
Well, it's a special book. And thank you both for taking part in sharing your story.
And I'll just say as well, also, I just want to chime in as well that it really, really means the world to us. Kind of like I mentioned, this book wouldn't be possible without the support of so, so, so many incredible people. People like teachers and librarians and supporters and mentors and so many people who brought this to life, but especially the readers and especially people like Hawaii Public Radio that are making it possible for us to share this story. We started off very, very small, just, you know, May and I thinking, all right, well, we really want to do this. We don't know who's going to see it or how many people are going to see it, but it means a lot to us. And so we wanted, you know, to bring it to life. And to see how much it has meant to so many people has been incredibly moving. And we are so, so grateful to everybody that has made it possible.
We've been hearing from Kaylin George and May White, the team behind the award-winning children's book, Aloha Everything. And since we last sat down with May and Kaylin, their book, Aloha Everything, has racked up yet another award, the Anui Nui Hawaii Keiki Award for 2025. More than 700 keiki voted for their favorite book and gave a thumbs up for Aloha Everything, the reader's choice. Congratulations. Well, that's it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, we plan to talk about Hula for Health. 20 years of research hails Hula's benefits. Has Hula helped you? Call our talkback line. Share your story. 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and D.W. Gibson, with support from Savannah Harriman Pote and the HPR Digital Team. The Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.